I am excited today to have Anne Hoffman on with me. Anne is the CEO, founder, and in some of your bios it says chief historian. I don't know what that means. SafeGraph. So maybe he'll explain to us what a chief historian does. But Anne's a real serial entrepreneur. I can't count how many companies he's founded and sold, and but quite a few. Also, a pretty well-known seed investor, and I think he's invested in 120 technology companies. That's at least on the website. We have met a few times, and he's a fascinating guy. So I'm super excited to talk to him about technology, and in particular about AI, which is something I'm trying to talk to a bunch of people about because people are so negative about it. All right. So welcome on. Thanks for joining us.
I'm excited to be here.
Good. So tell us a little bit, what is the chief, are you chief historian? Is there such a thing? And what does that even mean?
Well, I think for data companies, the most important thing is that it's true historically. And so if you think of what you're selling with data company, you're basically selling the past. You're selling a bit of history, yeah, and you're saying this is true. It doesn't mean it's going to be true in the future, just like any historical fact. If you said, okay, you know, who was president in 1923, it doesn't mean they're still president today. But at least you want to make sure that it's true in the past. And so much of data actually isn't true. So much of data in the past actually is inferences, or the data is fake, or the data has bugs in it. And so the more truthful the data is, the more you can rely on it.
So is the company, is SafeGraph, you know, how do you guarantee the truth of the data? Is there a particular process you guys go through as compared to competitors or other people who deal with data?
Yeah. So, I mean, each data company has a different kind of mandate. And depending on who you're selling to, just the value of how true it is, the value of the precision of the data may change. Yep. So if you're selling, let's say, data about a ticks of a stock ticker or something going back 100 years, and people are going to run regression models on that, then they really want to make sure that that data is quite accurate. And if you go back 100 years ago, you can have the tick of AT&T stock. Maybe back then the tick is only once per day, and now it's a tick of a tenth of a second or something like that. But I imagine that data is like 99.99% accurate. There might be a few inaccuracy from some fat finger things that go in there, but it's basically mostly true. And that's great. That means you can rely on that data, et cetera. There might be other types of people who buy data, let's say for marketing. Most types of people buy data for marketing, like the data just has to be like directionally accurate. So if you're sending, back in the day, you might be sending postal mail to people to send them a catalog. And you might want to send to people who really like own dogs, because you want to send them really cool things about dogs. And if you happen to send it to some people who own cats and not dogs, it's not the worst thing in the world. So that's the kind of, the different kind of levels of precision that people need when they're buying data.
And what is SafeGraph specialize in? What kind of data, and what do you guys do?
SafeGraph has really boring data about physical places. So if you want to know the store hours of your local cafe, like that's the type of data that we have. And so it's data that, okay, this cafe is open, this cafe is here. Oh, there was also another cafe that used to be there with a different name, but that cafe has closed. These are the up-to-date store hours. The store hours were different 6 months ago. The stores have changed. This is the shape of the place. This is the square footage of the place or square meters of the place. Just like basic information that you might want to rely on. And the good news about that is it is verifiable. Like you could send somebody there and check it out. So some data is very much, much more difficult to verify. And then there's not necessarily like equipment you have to worry about. So for instance, data about temperature, like you think data about temperature is actually quite reliable. And like in the high level, it is like, let's say within a few degrees, it's quite good. But, you know, like, let's say even in the city of San Francisco or something, there's lots of micro temperatures, and every single thermometer is going to be in a different position and may have different access to the sun. And some of it may have access to shade, and some of it might be not calibrated in the last 30 years. And so you're going to have various degrees of that. And so you may have to recalibrate it. And if you really want like the most accurate data, and then of course, if you're trying to get data about other, let's say, temperature things, other weather things, so the how fast the wind is going, or if you want to get humidity data or something, then, you know, this becomes a very, very difficult collection mechanism. People sometimes just think like the data out there is true. Most of the data is like directionally true. The data about the weather is usually quite directionally true, but it's rarely accurate.
Yeah, and then there are all kinds of other factors like other things that might be heating or cooling a particular location, but are not generalizable.
Yeah, exactly. You might be next to a factory or something, right? So, it's hard to say.
And would you say, just off topic, but would you say kind of the modeling that is being done in terms of climate, it takes into account how noisy the data is and accurately corrects for it?
I'm not a climate expert, so I'm not familiar with what they do and how they take, and it's possible for something that big, maybe you don't need to. So maybe if it's directionally accurate, kind of like with marketing, maybe you don't need like the super high precision, maybe just like the core stuff of just like the high level. If the temperature is like slightly different within a few degrees, or you take the average, you have, you know, maybe you have 50 thermometers in San Francisco and you just take the average of them, and that's kind of like roughly right. And near, you know, there might be different things that people do on all of these things that kind of work. If, you know, if you think of like GDP data, like it's definitely not true, like it's never accurate, but it might be true enough to rely on. It might be directionally correct, and we could still make decisions using it.
And then of course we need to know what it actually means, which is a whole other issue.
Yeah, that's right. And as you get an aggregate metric, like these things are more difficult. And sometimes the meaning changes over time. Like for instance, like, you know, the meaning of the S&P 500 changes over time. And so it's not always an apples to apples from like what it is today to what it was 20 years ago.
Yep. So let's step back a minute and tell us a little bit about your career. I mean, how you got into the startup business, I guess. You know, what led you to your first startup and how that has kind of evolved over time?
Well, I'm a software engineer by training. And so I had to pay my way through college, and I had a small business in high school that I thought was going to pay for all of my college. And it turned out I ran out of money after my third year of college. I needed to pay for my fourth year, my last year of college. And so like a lot of engineers did, start a little internet consultancy business at the time to just get enough money to pay for that last year. That ended up turning into not being employable. And so ended up in the kind of the startup realm ever since.
All right. And any kind of the big lessons learned from starting so many companies, you know, for somebody listening who might be in at the beginning of their career?
I mean, the startup people who run startups, there's a few different types of people who run startups. So the first type of person that runs a startup is like they have this product they really need to get done. And it's just so important for them to get done. And they really want to get this thing done. It could be because they want to be the customer, or they just care so deeply about it and just no one else is doing it. They're in some ways they're kind of like an accidental entrepreneur. Then there are people who start companies because they're essentially unemployable. They're a little bit of a misfit. They maybe don't fit well in a typical organization. They need to have an organization that actually fits around them, which most people wouldn't like bend the whole organization to them or something. And that's quite a lot of the people. And then, you know, recently you've seen some people that are like become founders because it's cool and it's trendy to do that. So the same reason somebody might join McKinsey or Goldman Sachs, you know, it's a good stamp on their shoulder. And there were fewer of those in the past because it was quite difficult to become a founder. Today with things like YC, Y Combinator, and, you know, lots of different online resources, et cetera, it's easier. And so you have that kind of like, you know, person who wants to be cool also sometimes becoming a founder too.
Interesting. Do you suspect that there's a quality difference?
There often is. Yeah, there often is. The person who wants to be cool, the founder, doesn't mean they can't be successful. They often can be quite successful, but they're probably much more likely to quit faster. Okay. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Quitting sometimes could be good if you have something that isn't working, and then they just, you know, go back to the job, you know, go back to the McKinsey job or whatever they were doing. And they're usually somebody who has lots of options, who can do lots of things. But the other two types of founders are probably much more likely to have some sort of persistence in doing what they need to do and not give up.
Yeah, which, as you said, sometimes is a liability, but maybe
it all depends. So sometimes the best companies need a bit of persistence. Yep. And when you think of like the most successful people, I'd say probably the most common trait amongst those people, and maybe the only common trait amongst those people, is persistence.
All right, so let's jump into this question of artificial intelligence. I've been now on a number of seminars, calls, talks, and, you know, it seems like the industry seems to be overwhelmingly, or at least the people who are doing these talks and seminars, seem to be overwhelmingly pessimistic about artificial intelligence, its future, and kind of there's a lot of end of the world out there, end of the world scenarios out there, which I think goes beyond AI. I think generally as a species, we tend to emphasize catastrophes and enjoy believing that a catastrophe is going to happen in our lifetime. But maybe start even a step. So I'm curious about what are the real risks involved? Because clearly there's some risk, but what are they really? Because of all these seminars, they keep talking about stuff, but they never really get to the nuts and bolts of what it is they're afraid of, other than a Terminator kind of scenario. The movie, I mean. So I'm curious about that, and then curious about how pessimistic, optimistic you are, and what you see as the upside. But maybe as a step back from that is, just because my audience is not technical necessarily, it's not in the field. What do we call artificial intelligence? What is the scope of what is today considered artificial intelligence, AI? Versus a lot of other kind of programs that do stuff in big data. So what is that? And then maybe I'll ask you what AGI is, and we'll go from there.
Well, basically, you can call anything AI. And I would say nowadays, every company is AI. Every tech company is an AI company. They've rebranded themselves as an AI company. And so it's very hard to find a tech company that, quote unquote, isn't doing AI today. And I think that's fine. So it's really about, you know, doing things with data, making predictions with data, filling in data, taking data and using that as a basis to create new data. That's, you know, basically what AI does. And sometimes it can look like magic, which is this, I think some of the reason things that have happened is super, super cool. But sometimes it could be like a very, very, very small thing that actually just like, automate something or make something faster, or, you know, does some sort of translation, or, you know, et cetera. So almost all of your users have used some sort of a large language model to do something. They've either used, like, you know, something like Google Translate to translate a document. Maybe they use Gmail and it like, or Google Docs and suggests words for them. So they type in like happy, and then it suggests birthday or something. Right. And so these are like really interesting. And then some people have probably used ChatGPT or Midjourney to create images or some of these other things. And they're incredible and amazing. I think one of the big risks that if you think the risk is that we just, these things won't move fast enough, that we're going to hit some sort of local maxima, and it will be very, it will need some sort of next level breakthrough that could be many, many years away. It's not given that it's just going to keep getting better and better and better. That could happen. But you could see a scenario where we kind of hit something and then like maybe get slightly better every year. And then it takes a long time until like a new breakthrough comes in.
And the risk there in a sense is that we don't, it doesn't live up to expectations. We don't get the GDP boost that everybody's expecting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could have all these things. I mean, we've been probably like self-driving cars have been 2 years away for the last 12 years. And, you know, really none of us have really experienced a self-driving car, maybe in like very, very, very confined things with, you know, but really not experienced the self-driving. Now we've gotten still some benefits from it. Maybe we, you know, almost every car today comes with a much better version of cruise control that you can use. There might be stopping, there might be understanding lane changing better. You can have automatic parking, which, you know, for even for the most advanced Tesla, like maybe works kind of, but not really that well. And so, you know, but like how far are we to like really go? Like imagine how society would change if we had self-driving cars, just like just the ability to just how you would do transportation and stuff like that, how you would take trips and stuff like that. You know, that would change drastically. Like that 7 hour car drive that seems such a drag that you never wanted to take. Now you might be much more willing to do it. You're just going to see a lot of transformations, but we're still, you know, maybe that's going to happen in 2 years, but maybe that's going to happen in like 200 years. Like, we just don't know.
What do you make of the self-driving cars in San Francisco, the self-driving taxis that they're using there?
I mean, there are a few of them. There are very, very few. It's very confined. It's not even all San Francisco. It's in parts of San Francisco. It's cool. It's really interesting. Yeah. But they're not exactly, you know, they're not at the point where there's a small number of them. There's actually just, there's more people than cars that work on the cars, right? They're monitoring the cars in real time. They're really understanding it. That's great to try things out. And it's really exciting. Mm-hmm. And for those people who've been in it, it is pretty incredible and it's really, really cool. But it's actually not cheaper than like having an Uber driver drive a normal car around for you yet, right? And so even with the payment of the driver. So it's exciting that something like that could happen. And we'll see. Like again, well, maybe that means we're 2 years away from you know, at least being able to buy your own. Maybe it's expensive, but at least being able to buy your own, and if you're somewhat wealthy, you could afford one. That would be incredible to start. But it also could be decades away. It's very hard to know.
Yeah, and it seems like that's a technology where the more people are using it, the cooler and the more leverage we get out of it, the more benefit we get out of it, the fewer accidents, and everything else. A few rich guys driving them would be cool for them. That would be great. And it will help the technology advance and it will help get the economies. But we all don't bet, you know, you're not going to see the immediate benefits from that.
And by the way, we even though like planes are much easier to drive today, much easier to fly than they were before, like they're not entirely self-driven planes really today. They still have pilots. And you know, you can have a drone that does certain things, but it doesn't have the same usefulness of like being able to take heavy cargo, et cetera. Even boats, you would think, oh, boats, that would be a really easy thing to have self-driving boats. It's like, it seems like such a simple thing, but there are really no self-driving boats. There's no self-driving, you know, you would think that would be really useful to have and, you know, be able to do some certain things, but those don't really exist yet. So we're still kind of in the very, very early innings of all this stuff.
Yeah. And but it's, as you said, super exciting and stuff to look forward to. So you know, everybody's using AI. I mean, I guess Siri and Alexa are forms of AI.
Yep.
And everybody's using it. It's out there. But ChatGPT seems to be, the latest versions seem to be some kind of leap forward that have created a lot of buzz, a lot of investment, but also a lot of this fear. So what is it about those models that is different, if anything, from what we've been using maybe for almost a decade now at, on some level.
These new large language models, these LLMs, are just much more powerful, and they can do things, they can do things that are like really cool and interesting, and that could be for good. So they might be able to help you analyze a legal document faster. They could, you know, potentially for evil, somebody could, impersonate you easier. They could mimic you. They could do a lot of other types of things. And so, you know, we'll see a lot more frauds. You can do things much faster. Sometimes before in a fraud, you needed a human on the other end of the fraud to chat with somebody. Maybe you don't need a human. So the frauds might be more scalable. There could be a lot of other things. So I think like all technologies, if you think of like whether it's the internet or whatever, it can be used for good or for bad. And there will be quite a bit of bad. And sometimes the bad stuff gets adopted first, because there's sometimes a lot of profit to do in the bad stuff.
Yeah. And
one of the other things I think is scary about LLMs in particular is the way they work. It can be very easy to make things up. And so just like basic stuff of like, what's 8 times 8? Even an old school computer from 50 years ago could answer that question accurately. But an LLM may not be able to answer that. It just is a different way of operating. And then you have to understand that for certain things, it can be really good. Like if you want like something very fact-based, LLMs are generally not so good. So if you want to ask a very, very, very specific question, like when was the Magna Carta signed or something like that, you'd probably be better off just typing that into Google or something. If you wanted to say, hey, I've got a, I wrote this piece and I want to rewrite it in the language that was used in the Magna Carta in that kind of way and that kind of phrasing, then an LLM is going to be very creative. And so it's an amazing creativity tool.
Yeah.
This is where the writer strike, the Hollywood writer strike, to me makes no sense. To me, the folks that are most likely to benefit from the LLMs are the writers. If they are somewhat technical, you can use these LLMs because nowadays you can create images, you can create video. So all the stuff that the writers weren't able, you can have actors, digital actors do it for you in digital voices. So essentially the writer, someone still has to create the plot. The writer can actually now produce, or very soon can produce, the whole movie. So it seems like the writers are going to be the ones who most benefit, and they're not going to need the studios. They're not going to need all this other stuff. They're going to have the opportunity to be, very, very entrepreneurial. It feels like the people who should go on strike are like maybe the graphic designers and, some of these other folks that help make, maybe even the actors that help make the movies.
But are the writers worried about the computer doing the plot as well? That is, at what level does that creativity stop? Couldn't you train one of these models to kind of look at plots throughout history?
And then it seems like the other stuff will happen just as fast. And so somebody still is going to have to like create the story, market the story. Writers are often become producers. And so somebody has to like package what you're doing and put it together and sell it. And it seems like the most likely type of person who can do that would be the writer. Right. So I think in general, these writers are a little bit short-sighted, and they'll probably do things that are not necessarily, they're probably doing things today that are not necessarily in their long-term best interest.
And they could actually use these tools to write better, but also take over the industry.
Completely take over the industry. And so, you could see a scenario where the writers have the power, the agents don't have the power, the studios don't have the power, like it completely upends. And that may happen. You might see a group of people go do it. Now, not all of these writers are entrepreneurial. Not all of them like want that opportunity to go do that. Some of them just want they just want a job to go do stuff. Yeah. But you could potentially see this, the opportunity to really upend some things.
So what is your view on the one of the sources of fear that is out there, and that is that just jobs are going to go away. I mean, there's just not going to be any jobs because these models, these software can do so many things that people are already doing today.
Well, it's a reasonable fear that jobs will change. And possibly certain jobs might go away and certain types of things might be harder to do, et cetera. But you know, even there are more bank tellers today than there were, you know, in the 1980s. So it's very hard to predict what's going to go away and what's going to happen. I think one of the big fears that's happening right now is that, traditionally, technology has been very good at upending more blue-collar jobs, and really not going after the more college degree jobs.
Yep.
It seems like LLMs actually are much better at going after the four-year college degree jobs than the blue-collar jobs. And I think that is probably why it's causing more consternation, because the people who are writing about it are the ones who are most worried about it. The blue collar jobs potentially could be in more demand than they were before. And, you know, you're seeing certain, even like UPS drivers, you're seeing their salaries start to go up, and some of them now can make in the $150,000-$175,000 a year, like a very, very, very livable, more than a livable wage, you know, twice the median income in the US. So you're starting to see different types of folks get affected from this technology. But the other thing is, like, can it eliminate some of the drudge work? So if you think of, like, if you're a lawyer, a very high priced lawyer, like, the thing you hate doing is like this long document review where you're taking this like 120 page document. You have to read it line by line, super carefully, look for the gotchas, you know, all this other stuff. You want to do the much more creative, much more interesting types of things. So if you had the technology to help you reduce that time, instead of having to read all 120 pages, maybe you only have to read equivalent of 3 pages, because it really helps you. It doesn't do all of it, but it helps you narrow down what you really have to dive into, really have to look at. This other stuff's all boilerplate. You can imagine this could be really, really, really good for people, and that could reduce, you know, maybe it reduces overall legal bills, but it still makes the lawyers happier and allows them to work on things that are much more interesting and much more high value to them.
Yeah, and we know from every other technology that's been contested and the fears about losing jobs. Yeah, some jobs get destroyed and get lost, but it seems like every technological revolution, more jobs get created than are lost. Not necessarily in the same field, not necessarily in the same area, but somewhere in the economy.
And again, like, there are people who argue that has been true in the future, in the past, but that it doesn't mean that that's true in the future. And I don't know, but we'll see. We haven't yet seen some of these things. And I would say 15 years ago, like, the area, if you were a doctor, like, the last place you wanted to go into was radiology to look at all these different scans and stuff like that. That would have been a mistake not to go into that. That's been an incredibly interesting field to be in the last 15 years. Yeah, maybe one day AI really takes it over. But more likely, AI is going to be there assisting you, helping get rid of the drudgery. Those jobs have continued to be very sought after, very well-paid jobs. And so it's also just extremely hard to predict. And I think that is part of the consternation, that it's not that that necessarily jobs are going to go away. It's that we have no idea which jobs are going away. And so it'd be really hard to know. And so it's like, in 1990, if you were in college and you majored in nuclear engineering, this was probably a very bad place to go. Turned out like just weren't that many jobs really for most of these engineering jobs. A lot of them just kind of went away, and they weren't as, it turned out that if you went into a field that was much less rigorous, which at the time was computer science, whether those were like the B students went into computer science, and the less mathematical oriented people, that turned out to be, so it's very, very hard to know And then today, you know, maybe the better students are going to computer science, but maybe they should be doing, you know, they should be doing something else. In fact, sometimes where you see everyone go is almost certainly the place you shouldn't go.
Yep. I mean, predicting the future has always been tough and always,
it's always hard. Right. Yeah.
Always be tough.
Yeah. And if you ask someone like 200 years ago, like, hey, if you were like an amazing basketball player, you could make all this money. Like, that would be like, that's crazy. That like doesn't make any sense. So you have no idea even what sport is going to be, you know, super popular in the future.
I think there's certain principles you can know in the sense that human desires seem to be infinite and human imagination seems to be quite extensive or close to infinite. So the opportunities only grow with technology, even if we can't imagine where they're going to be. And they might be more blue collar, they might be more white collar, they might be more in becoming writers and packaging movies and creating them all yourself. I mean,
yeah.
Who knows where they're going to be, but they will be there because we want stuff, physical and, you know, physical stuff and spiritual stuff. We're huge consumers of stuff like that, and we need producers. So AI is in a sense everywhere. It's only going to get bigger. These large language models are really incredible in what they do, and there is a certain element of magic behind them. What is it that creates that sense of magic in terms of what they're doing behind the scenes? How do these models work that creates that sense of magic that we get when we use them?
I mean, you know, really what they're doing is they're just really in some ways like building relationships between things. And they're saying this thing has some sort of relationship with this other thing. Just, you know, back a few years ago when you type in happy and it's like kind of auto completing it with birthday, right? Yep. It kind of knows that, you know, those things tend to go with one another. And if you think of a translation engine, it's looking for things that were translated. So in the EU, you have a lot of documents that were translated from one to the other, and then they could train on that and it could help you kind of understand that. So these different things now, I think they're starting to be infused with data. And that is really powerful and interesting. And if you think of data, most data has four nouns, is really about four nouns. So it's either data about people, like Orrin Hoffman, it's data about a place, like this McDonald's on 555 Main Street. It's data about an organization or a company. So like McDonald's Inc. would be the organization, or it's data about like a product, like the Big Mac or the fries, or, you know, some sort of product, a 2-liter bottle of Coca-Cola. And all that data could be crossed with one another. It could also be crossed with time and with price. But that is the kind of substance. If you just think of data as like, it's really, really just about those four nouns and having actually some truth in the world that we can look at, and not this kind of like fake news data, but like true truth, is becoming increasingly important if we're going to rely and kind of fine tune some of this AI.
So given that there's a lot of this fake news and a lot of nonsense out there on which some of this AI is training itself or making connections, right? So it's making connections between, and some of it is not true. Some of it is clearly false. How does that evolve, and are there mechanisms of how are people thinking about how do we separate out the stuff that's false? Can we teach the AI to discover that?
I think you can, all the above, and being able to weight different sources is going to be important. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to know what is true, and you know, is, how do I even know that this is a 2-liter bottle of Coke, right? And so I've got to read it, I got to look at it, and, you know, a human can kind of understand that, but, you know, these things, and then how is that different from a 1-liter bottle of Coke or a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke? And they're somewhat related to one another, right? But they're, you know, they kind of look similar, they have similar color, they taste a little different, the same company. And then like a 2 liter bottle of Coke is also related to 2 liter bottle of Pepsi, right? And so really kind of understanding these kind of like relationships and differences is exciting. And I think that's where we're going to see this kind of like data categorization is going to be very important in the future as well. Right now, really what most of these LLMs have been trained on is just like random crawls of the web. And then that could be anything. And some of them high veracity sources, but some of them are just like completely people just randomly, ranting about a particular ethnic group or talking about, whatever it might be, or, and faking, the moon landing, whatever it is that people might be wanting to talk about on the internet. So understanding some of this and really trying to understand what's real and what's not is hard. And it is hard.
It's objectively hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's objectively super hard. Like, I have never personally proved that, like, we landed on the moon in 1969. Like, I'm assuming it's correct, but I haven't gone up there and, like, checked it out for myself. In some ways, you just have to, like, there's still this, like, no one can prove first principles everything. Although if you try to do that, you'd become the Unabomber. Like, it'd just be impossible to go through life. So there is kind of, like, a trust system where you have to trust something that trusts something else and then build upon, we stand on the shoulders of giants, build upon what other people have done as well.
And it seems like whoever's going to start categorizing sources as trustworthy or not trustworthy is going to have a lot of power over these models.
Yeah, that's right. And then of course, a lot of these things are somewhat verifiable. So if I say that Orrin Hoffman is a man, and he turns out to be a man, okay, well then that's good.
These days I'm not sure how verifiable it is, but
that's right. So some of these things might be hard to even that might be a hard to verifiable. If it said that
even the mushy definitions that
exactly
some people have embraced.
Exactly. And you say Orrin Hoffman went to UC Berkeley. Okay, well that can we verify that? Do we know that's true? And then if the more I say is true, maybe you get some points, the more you say, you get maybe 1 point for everything is true, maybe you get negative 20 points for everything that's false or something, you have some sort of score.
So some of the fear mongering is around this idea that this will reinforce certain negatives in our culture, reinforce fake news and maybe have political implications in terms of elections and so on. Is that something you worry about or you think is a real threat?
I think it's certainly something we should worry about. It's hard to know how bad of a threat is it. I mean, a lot of social media gets blamed for a lot of stuff today. It's not clear to me that social media is like worse than TV news or something. Yep. Right. Now you might say, well, social media feeds TV news and makes TV news worse or something like that. It's hard to know these correlations between maybe TV news feeds social media. It's not clear which one is worse, which one is cigarettes and, which one is the cocaine. So it's hard to know. But it seems like neither of them are like that good for you to have in bulk. So maybe it's okay to have like one cigarette a week, but it's probably not good to have one cigarette every minute. I think that's, partially what, some of these things that are out there. And of course, there's goodness, TV news, there's not that much good that comes out of TV news. There might be a little bit here and there, but it's probably mostly bad. And social media, at least you can like stay in touch with your friends and your family and see your friend's cat and understand what your, old neighbor B is up to. And she baked this cool new pie and stuff like that. And so it might, there could be some certain community aspects that are maybe underweighted as well.
And social media allows you to participate in the process, whereas TV news is very much you as a consumer.
Yeah, that's right.
And not as a participator.
That's right. And again, that could be good or bad, depending on how that participation, comes in, and obviously all these things can be weaponized. People have been weaponizing rumors and innuendo for centuries. So these things aren't new, and it's very easy to spread conspiracy theories and lots of stuff, even well before you had social media. And it's not clear that like fake news is spreading any faster today than it ever did in the past. It was always a problem in our society. Maybe it's more easy to recognize that's a problem today, but it was always a problem. And I mean, an AI could have the same implications. And I don't want to be I think we should be worried. There's a lot of bad stuff that can happen, and there's a lot of bad stuff that certainly will happen. Like, you can predict for, and certain bad stuff that's already happening. And just our own safety and just all the different frauds and people impersonating us. It becomes, you know, all of a sudden you call me, like, I don't even know if I can trust it anymore. And that's not as good. You have less trust in society that could potentially happen. So there's all these implications that we have to build a more resilient society around.
Yeah, these seem to be things that we've kind of, to some extent or another, always had to deal with, and that I assume that the people in the field are thinking about and concerned about, and going to, the good guys at least are going to put in as many safeguards as they can for sure. These kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the losing the jobs that comes with every technological innovation. You know, all these ideas about the corruption of social media, the corruption of AI politically, that's existed in other forms in the past. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, just a long time ago, television was going to destroy our minds. Children were going to be completely destroyed by television, and parents were criminal for letting kids watch television even a few hours a day. So the fear seems to be very similar to what it was.
And the fear is warranted. If you, technology has been used for, technology was used very effectively to spread lots of bad, you know, the radio was used very effectively to spread lots of bad stuff in the 1930s. And so, I mean, it will be used by bad guys, like, for sure. They will use it. They will find ways to use it and access it. And there are a lot of, the world isn't just filled with good people. There are bad people in the world who are going to do bad stuff. And so you have to guard against it.
It's the catastrophizing that usually, in almost every realm you see it in our culture.
And that is something that I'm a bit worried about, is that in San Francisco, where I spent almost all my adult life until very recently, it used to be an incredibly optimistic place. It used to be a place where you're really thinking about the future. Everyone was not, I wouldn't say everybody, but the vast majority of people were thinking about the future. They were optimistic about the future. They're working on something future oriented. And then at some point in the last, let's say, 10 years, it became much more of a catastrophizing place. The world is ending place. And this is even pre-AI. Just thinking about, like, you know, whether it's these are might be warranted things, like the environment or something like that. But instead of, like, on the environment stuff, like, okay, I'm going to create a technology solution to change it, it was like, oh, the world's just going to end, and you know, people kind of giving up in a way, and that is and people, I think, became less happy, less optimistic, less looking toward the future, much more insular, maybe more willing to fight with people, more zero sum, and that, I think, in general, has not been good for society.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that completely. Do you see anywhere else that may be attracting the more optimistic people? Is there a movement of the better, of the more positive people out of San Francisco to somewhere else, or people just scattering?
I think people are scattering. So there's less of, like, a place. Obviously, people are online, they're in the cloud, and so in some ways, it's like the cloud is attracting these types of people, and optimistic people will find other optimistic people. And you know, the way, simple way to be optimistic is just to surround yourself with other optimistic people. It's the same way to be happy. If you want to be happy, you just be with happy people and you will almost certainly be happy. And one of the ways to be sad is just to be around sad people, or if you want to be pessimistic, be around. So you can choose. And so there are certain people who are, like, choosing to be pessimistic. They're choosing to be unhappy. That's something they're making, actually, a choice to do. You think that's weird. Like, why would someone choose to be unhappy? But sometimes really smart people really like the pessimism. It's sometimes very, there's something about it. It's really good. Smart people are very good at finding problems. They're very good at this kind of thing. In fact, you know, I think the smarter you are, sometimes the easier it is to be pessimistic about stuff because you can find all the flaws in everyone's argument. And so sometimes people just choose to be it. And it's much easier in life if you try to, you don't have to be unduly optimistic. You don't have to have complete blinders on. But if you start with a little bit more of an optimistic lens, life is a little bit more fun and a little bit more interesting.
A lot more fun. So how do you differentiate between what's called AGI? Maybe you could tell us what AGI is and the current state of AI.
Well, there's this idea of artificial general intelligence where at some point the computer can teach itself to get better. And in some ways, like part of that really comes with like, can computers continue to write code and can that code be self-reinforcing? Can it get really, really, and keep getting better at that point? Like you could potentially see if they could truly write it in the right way, you could see, like an exponential growth in intelligence on a system. Whereas right now, most of these systems are really bounded by people. Yep. They're bounded by us, and we move slowly. And we don't, especially when we're in groups, we move even more slowly. And we have committees, and we have all these different things that kind of slow us down. And we have a limit on our own intelligence. So you know, even the smartest human is only so smart. And sometimes the people with the highest IQ are, in some ways, they're smart at some things, but they're actually quite stupid at other things. Yep. And so, you know, potentially a self-reinforcing thing could lead to an exponential growth. And everyone defines AGI in a very, very different way. So it's hard to define it. But I think the simple way is like, once the computer can write code and get itself better, it's like what we could do in like 10 years, potentially the computers could do in one day. And then the next hour is like the last day. And then the next minute's like the last hour. And it just becomes this like crazy thing. And that's what people are both excited about and also incredibly concerned about. Because you could, you know, the worry of course is that you would have this system that, is not necessarily doing what's in the best interest of humankind. They may have other optimization functions that humans may not be able to outsmart it or unplug it. These are all the dystopian, and I think all of them have legitimate concerns. So you do have to think about that. I think saying over playing the concern is a problem, but underplaying the concern, saying it's not, is also somewhat of a problem as well. I don't know exactly where I fit on that continuum, but you can't be a 0 or 100. You have to be like somewhere in between.
And to what extent does this assume that the computer becomes conscious? That is, it becomes self-aware in some way, or is this independent of any kind of self-awareness?
It's always hard to say, and even if it's like not, it's hard to even define what self-aware is, and and everyone has different definitions of it, and there's all these like linguists that debate it and stuff like that. But even if it's not quote unquote self-aware, if it starts to have some sort of optimization function that diverges from like what's good for humanity, that could be bad, right? And obviously, like a lot of humans themselves have optimization functions that could be bad for humanity. It's very hard to know, but in some ways, humans could cancel one and out. So they're out as long as nobody like launches a bunch of nuclear missiles or something like that. Like we kind of like deal with it, and someone might do stupid things or, you know, whatever, and other people can kind of like cancel. But if you have this like all powerful thing that starts to, or a few all powerful things, and they start to move society in a way that's like really bad for humanity, and that's not as cancelable, then I think that could be problematic.
And so, and where do you think we are on this path towards AGI?
It's very hard to say. It's another thing that people have been predicting about for a very long time. And you know, some people think it's 5 years away. Some people think it's 500 years away. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows.
Okay. So this idea that we don't even have self-driving cars yet, that doesn't give you any kind of sense that maybe we're quite far from you know, this kind of scenario?
It's hard to say. It could be because of these things that they could be weird step functions that could come in. Okay. And it's hard to predict it like linearly out. Yeah. So if I don't think we'll have AGI if we don't have any step functions anytime soon, because it doesn't seem like if you just like extrapolate it out, we're going to get there in 5 or 10 years. But there's not to say that we won't have any step functions. And there are people writing, you know, working on kind of self-code stuff today. Code is kind of the building block for AGI. And so the more things could self-code, and these are very smart, intelligent people, and there's a lot of companies working on it, and part of what OpenAI is doing, and there's a lot of other kind of projects that are on there. And as those become more successful, and right now they're kind of like, they kind of help humans write code better, or they debug code, or they do a bunch of other types of things, you know, quite well. But they're not like self-driving code in a way, right? And if you can start to imagine a whole new system where it's like writing code on its own and really kind of thinking about it and really kind of healing on its own, then, you know, maybe it could get very, very, very quote unquote smart, very, very fast.
Is, you know, you talk about the kind of the function the determines what the code is written and how it's written. Is that something people are thinking about in terms of you could write that in like a constitution in advance so that it only develops code in a particular direction?
Yeah, maybe that's what people are thinking about for sure. But it's hard to do. And just like in our constitution, it can be interpreted very, very weird in very weird ways. And even if you try to think you're using precise language, people might think about it different. And doesn't mean someone can't disregard it. They might think, well, these people didn't, you know, people are fallible and they wrote it this way. It didn't make sense the way they did it. So I'm just going to disregard it. So it's hard to know how these things play out.
I mean, disregarding seems to imply a consciousness, but you know.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And maybe at that point, it may have more of a consciousness. Yeah.
So what would you say? So there's a lot of talk about the downsides of that, obviously, you know, having a function that dictates an anti-human perspective. But what are the upsides of the technology?
I mean, the upsides are incredible. On almost on every front, really, and it's hard to know what comes in, you know, first. But we should be able to we should be able to do things like drug development much better. We should be able to live much healthier. We should be able to understand things better. We should be able to be much more creative. You know, for instance, I've been using, I don't know how many of your listeners have used Midjourney. It's a basically it's like an image creation tool without using things like LLMs. And I'm somebody who would always want to be able to draw and kind of be creative, but doesn't have the ability or really the aesthetics to do it. But I can write. And so just writing a few prompts, like, you know, two geezers having a podcast, you know, and creating, I can create a whole story about what's going on here and create an image and potentially create video and even have it. And that's really exciting. And I've been doing that with my kids and it's fun and it's interesting. And it's given me this whole other world in the last 6 months that I've never really had access to. I've always wanted to paint, but I never could. Like, I never had that ability to do that, like, kind of real creative thing that gives so much of humanity pleasure. And now anybody could do it. And that's like really cool and really exciting. So there's just like, I think there's a spirituality side that could happen as well. And, you know, there's just a lot of secrets of humanity and secrets of the world that we just don't know. You know, we don't know what our diet should be. We don't know, we don't know how to have best relationships with our spouse. You know, there's all these things that potentially we could have an assistant to help us with, and do it. If you think of even though like the movie Her was kind of a dark movie, and I love that movie. I think it's a beautiful and great movie. You know, there's points of it which are also just like exciting and exhilarating and inspiring as well. And you know, you don't have to have the dark side. You could have the just the exciting, exhilarating side to it.
And is, you know, if you had to sum up your view of what it is, given all the uncertainty and everything, are you on the side of more excited about the upside than worried about the downside?
I am, but that is also a bias of my personality, not sure. Necessarily because like my data shows that one should be. And I think it is, you know, one of those things that you should be worried about. You know, if this is like 1945, like we should be worried about nuclear war, but like you also have these people who are super excited about low cost energy and like kind of neither of them came to pass. In both worlds were not like as predicted. And so I think you always have to, you know, be vigilant and thinking some of these things through, and whatever you predict is likely not going to be correct.
So one of the explanations that are given for why we didn't get the low cost energy is that the industry very early on got heavily regulated by the government, partially because it was used for national defense, but also partially because of the fear that
yep.
commercial development entailed. And there's a lot of talk in the industry for government to come in. And I've even heard people talk about modeling the kind of regulatory regime after the regulatory regime of the nuclear energy. And I'm thinking to myself, do you know what that did to the industry? Right? Is that really the solution? Do you have any sense of where that's heading? You know, do you have a preference in terms of how that is done or if it's done at all?
I think if you're a very large company in this space, then it's in your interest to have as much government regulation as possible and have government capture. Maybe it does slow down innovation, but it keeps you in the lead. And so that's generally would be good for you. If you are a startup, if you're somebody who is trying to build technology or trying to change things, then this would be quite bad for you. But of course, these big companies have like way more power than you do. And so I predict that they probably will be somewhat successful in what they are doing, because they are trying to self-preserve and they're trying to box out other kind of entrants. Now, the good news is all these companies have, they're also trying to box out each other. And they have their own differing views of things. It's not like Google and Microsoft and Apple and Amazon are all kind of like necessarily love one another either. So they're going to play in a way where they're going to try to have the lowest common denominator, which protects them. Because you know, it's not like they're all oil companies or something where they have like exact common interest. And then the rest of the stuff still will be, you know, potentially quite opportunistic for other players to come in on.
All right. Well, let's hope that the more optimistic version is the version that becomes reality, and we get to experience that amazing future.
That'd be great.
Yeah, that would be the ideal. Thanks, Owen. I really appreciate you taking the time and joining me here. This has been fun.
Thank you so much. And yeah, if any of your listeners want to reach out to me on Twitter at Oren, AUREN, I'm happy to chat with them as well.
Yeah. And you also, do you still do the blog or the, where you recommend? You don't?
Oh yeah. I do blogs. I've got this five links thing. I've got spam people, everything, all of the above.
Tell us how they can get in touch with you.
The best way is Twitter, honestly, or X, or whatever you call it now. So just at Oren, AUREN. Fairly good if someone asks me, replying to them and having a conversation with them.
Great. Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.